you're rolling. So Ariel's like a professional videographer, editor, but her iPhone only has one lens, camera lens. So
you can upgrade. You need 17.
Big, heavy cameras. Is that your main gig? Okay. iPhone's for birds for you, I guess.
I feel like the iPhone camera's gotten so good it often rivals even the best 4K cameras.
Yeah. I don't use my professional camera anymore.
What do you use, Bigfoot? iPhone?
Android.
Oh.
Oh. Supposed to care. Android, iPhone debate.
Yeah. All right. Good to see you guys.
It's good
awesome.
To be back.
Lots going on. It's an exciting time right now. We've got some exciting news about Rick Pastor.
Yeah. Very exciting.
Well received. People come up to me all the time and talk to me about how much they love the guy. He's been here a while.
Really well, only a quarter century.
He's a true innovator, an academic. He's excited about the role. And
just saw you guys having breakfast. Was trying to get him to come join us, but
he's
run to a meeting.
He's got a lot of meetings.
We just had breakfast with him, and I think we're excited that Rick is stepping up to take over Cedar. And you know, people may not know, but Rick and I have been working hand in glove the last few months, maybe about 5-6 months, because for a long time, the Oncology Center of Excellence, which Rick has been running, was supposed to be a go-between between Cedar and CBER. But across all the different indications, all the different cancers, there wasn't always alignment. You know, sometimes they demanded one thing and we demanded another thing. Sometimes our standards were a little bit different. Sometimes communication wasn't free-flowing. That's all changed. Now it is organ system by organ system. People are talking to each other. We're getting clarity and consistency across endpoints and CDER and CBER. And it's been a lot of fun. You know, you're in a room with a bunch of the best oncologists talking about the best science. And so I've enjoyed working with Rick the last few months.
Yeah, he's really terrific. I have too. He is really a team player. But when you said there hasn't always been great alignment, I think that's putting it mildly. There's been sort of infighting here, you know, territorial, tribal lines, gerrymandering of what goes in what center and what goes in oncology and what goes
like
here.
Medieval Europe, you know, a lot of warring clans.
For yes, a lot of clans. Yes.
And now the Roman Empire is coming. No,
we're one team, right? You know, one organization, one FDA.
Well, that's the cool thing. And that has been the prerequisite for serving in leadership here is you have to be able to serve the broader mission of the agency and engage in impeccable teamwork like we've never seen before here at the agency. So it's going terrific. And I'm really excited.
You know, what makes Rick unique is that he's a career regulator. He's been here for a quarter century, but he's also an innovative thinker. He's not stuck in doing things the way they were. And for years, he's been innovating in the oncology space. You know, we don't have to go through the list, but there's been dozens of things from achieving harmony across the U.S. and Europe, dosing, moving randomized trials to the front line, using a single seamless trial design, a lot of innovations in the oncology space, and a lot of things that he has planned for how to make reviews more efficient. We've been impressed by talking to him about all his ideas for making reviewers go faster and be able to provide more timely feedback to sponsors. And I can tell you one thing that he pitched to me just the other day was just like we've been working together in oncology, creating alignment between CBER and CDER, he proposes that we have a similar team of people in cardiology, nephrology, to create alignment and rare diseases, to create alignment between the two centers. And I'm an enthusiastic supporter of that. You know, whether you're a biologic gene therapy or a small molecule inhibitor, if it's the same disease population, sponsors should expect some consistency in how CBER and CDER will treat you. And I think that's good for the public, it's good for patients, it's good for sponsors, and Rick and I will work together to get that through.
It's something we heard a lot in the CEO listening tour as well, right? That inconsistency. So that's good that you guys are thinking about that.
Yeah, we talk about it a lot. And when you say have the reviewers work faster, we're not talking about increasing the workload. We're just talking about cutting the idle time. And that is the key. And so right now, if you get your reviews done in, let's say, 8 weeks, because so many other people involved in that review have until, say, a year, then you're not accelerating the decision to go out. We're not, you know, we're not moving the ball forward. And so we can create more alignment here. And that just reduces the stacks of paperwork, so to speak. These are obviously in the computer system, but that, you know, conceptually, the idea of the stacks of papers on your desk are lower. There's more decisions going out. And so there's less of a backlog.
Is it fair to call it like parallel tracking a lot of the reviews and steps of the review?
Yeah, I think alignment's a good word. And you and I, have been big fans of Rick's concept of using surrogate markers. And we've talked many, many times before you came in, when you came in, when we met with Rick, and after that, we believe in both
surrogates and clinical endpoints.
And clinical endpoints.
And that's what Rick has done. Rick is, you run a single trial based on an early look at the study and a surrogate endpoint is better, you get an accelerated approval. Then you just follow that trial out a year or two later, confirm what we've already, what we expect and hope, just to make sure it's true. Or you think of another way you can get at that question, which we're going to talk about credibility in a minute. But you think of other ways you can address, is this doing what I think it's doing?
Yeah. And even outside of accelerated approvals, we have now reliable surrogate endpoints that we think are validated markers of clinical benefit. And so if...
So this is something that maybe people don't fully appreciate, which is that you can receive an accelerated approval if the surrogate is reasonably likely to predict a clinical benefit.
Okay.
But you can receive a regular or traditional approval for a surrogate endpoint that is... that has been validated to predict clinical benefit. And we actually, you know, in CBER, you're going to see some of that. You're going to see some things where you're going to see a surrogate endpoint. The ball is hit so far out of the park that it doesn't make sense to have an accelerated approval. It's going to get a traditional approval.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really cool stuff. I think, you know, we have to innovate the regulatory process. We can't just keep using the same process. We have to keep that process impeccably independent. And at the same time, we have to think about what to do differently. And Rick has really innovated the regulatory process, in my mind, more than anyone here at the agency. I mean, Project Orbis, the whole concept of surrogate endpoints, going from a baseline default two clinical trial requirement down to one with a confirmatory trial or post-marketing commitment of some kind afterwards. He has really been thinking differently. And I think, you know, when we have proposed ideas agency-wide here in our broader work on drug reform, oftentimes he'll say at the meeting, we've been doing that in the OCE for years.
Yeah. And people haven't followed our lead. But now hopefully more people
that'll change, yeah.
Like, you talked about independence, and I think that's an important word because I see sometimes people confuse two things. When we talk about independence, we want our decisions to be made based on the science and the public and patient interest. You know, first and foremost, the science and public and patient interest, not special interests, you know, but the public still has an ultimate say in how the FDA works. And I think that's important to emphasize that this is not a place where there's a fourth branch of government setting the policies. It's the public who we're ultimately accountable to through their elected representatives and the laws they pass in terms of helping us balance that speed, certainty, spectrums, helping us balance how promising things are, how quick to bring them to market. The public makes that decision.
On the innovating the process, I know you both have been talking a lot about, you know, different study requirements and, you know, what do you need to do here? How do you both think about the credit, maintaining credibility and reliability and all of that?
I mean, I think what we want to see is evidence that something works, right? That, I mean, that's the ultimate question. And so, you know, maybe the old Bayesian statistical model can be seen in a new light now where we can run continuous statistical analysis with AI in real time and have stopping rules that are maybe not linear. You know, maybe they're curvilinear. Maybe they account for the fact that every drug is different and every population is different. And so the old idea that everything has to hit 0.05, you can actually mathematically have more power in a study with a single study than two separate studies, which has been the default requirement the FDA has had.
No, people are obsessed with this, with one thing here or there. But what Marty's pointing out is credibility. So, you know, what we care about FDA is, does this product actually help you live longer or live better? And there's all sorts of ways credibility is demonstrated. One is effect size. You know, is it a very small difference or is it a huge difference? And when you have a drug that makes a huge difference, you can see the effect from space. You know, the drug imatinib in chronic myeloid leukemia turned a disease with a median survival of 3 to 4 years to one with normal life expectancy of like 27 years. This has been shown in Swedish data, population data. When people say, oh, you can't use observational real-world data, yeah, you can. For Gleevec, look at the SEER data. Look at Sweden's reports. Like, you can see the effect of Gleevec from space. You could stand on a mountaintop and see that the survival curves are different in a population of people with the disease. We also think about pre-specification of endpoints. We want you to paint the target on the wall and then shoot for the target, not shoot at the wall and paint later, you know? So pre-specification matters. The choice of controls matter. In other words, what are you comparing against? Is it the best available care or something beneath it? After somebody has disease progression or the disease gets worse, what are the kinds of treatments they're getting? Are those on par with the U.S. standard? What about the endpoint? Is it a validated surrogate, a surrogate we have confidence in, or is it a completely novel surrogate? Even novel can be useful if it has a lot of biologic rationale. And then do you hit the target? Are all the intermediate clinical endpoints consistent with the big treatment effect? So I hear people obsessed with how many studies. It's not about quantity. It's about the quality of the evidence generated from a totality of these factors. And then the last thing you said was Bayesian. So pretest probability matters. So for instance, a new Alzheimer's drug, although we want Alzheimer's breakthroughs, that's, you got to be a little bit more skeptical of that than a new drug that helps somebody with a blood clotting factor deficiency. Clotting factors we've been making for decades, and they have all, you know, pretty much all work. Alzheimer's drugs we've tried for decades, and they've pretty much mostly failed. And so your pretest probability changes in those two classes. And so Marty's talking about being a Bayesian. That's a statistician who takes into account priors, your prior confidence in a hypothesis. And I think we have a Bayesian framework coming, a clinical guidelines coming, yep, from our centers that will lend credence to that. But like you said, like being so wedded to one of these things, oh, the p-value has to be 0.05. Oh, it has to be two trials. Oh, it has to be, being wedded to any one thing without looking at the totality, that's myopic. That's not good regulatory science.
And so, you know, talking out loud here on this, you know, on camera here, these are the things we're talking about. You know, should we have this default Bayesian requirement of two clinical trials for a as a requirement? Can we use non-Bayesian statistics to answer the question, does something work? Can we ask ourselves, what should the requirements of real-world data be? And can we let the companies know this is what we'd like to see in real-world data, but then not have limitations on what they're allowed to submit in terms of real world data? And so these are all things we're talking about right now. We're socializing these ideas. We want there to be a consensus within the agency, and we want to do the right thing. But these are things we are actively talking about. And hopefully in the coming months, we'll have some good announcements. We want to do things right. We're on path with our animal testing.
Yep.
Roadmap to reduce animal testing requirements. We're on path with a lot of these ideas that we've been getting from our listening sessions. And so anyway, good stuff is happening across the board. And the National Priority Review Voucher Program, I think going very well. The first review, I thought, went beautifully, incredible discussion. And it shows the feasibility of the program. You know, this is kind of a minimal viable product initial run. But I'm excited about some of these potentially promising treatments. And some of them are in your field of oncology.
You got a lot of oncologists around here now. You got me, you got Rick, you got, you know, you're running.
Too many.
Yeah, tell us a little bit more.
Oh, you can never have too many oncologists.
Yeah. You want to tell us more about those oncology products?
Yeah, let's talk about it. So the two we've announced so far, zongertinib and dostarlimab, two really important products in the oncology space. So one is for a subset of non-small cell lung cancer called HER2 mutant non-small cell lung cancer. So what do you need to know? You know, for so many years, lung cancer was divided into the small cell variety, which often affected smokers, and the non-small cell variety, which also often affects smokers. But there was a subgroup of people in that non-small cell category, tend to be younger, Asian, female, non-smokers, who developed lung cancer. And over the years, we've learned that a number of activating mutations actually is responsible for cancer in those people, including in EGFR, ALK rearrangement, BRAF. And now we're learning about HER2, which is yet another, it's the same HER2 that's present in breast cancer. It's the same HER2 that Dennis Lehman and others developed trastuzumab for, at one of the first targeted therapies done by Genentech. And now we have a small molecule inhibitor that when given to the patients with this type of lung cancer, this unique lung cancer, it results in dramatic tumor shrinkage and dramatic response rate. We're talking about 70% of people have their tumors shrink 30% or more in clinical studies.
Does that change what additional care you need as part of that, like the amount of chemotherapy or that you would need?
Well, it would be in lieu of chemotherapy. Okay. I mean, in lieu of chemotherapy or in lieu of a perhaps a less potent HER2-directed strategy. But you're talking about, like, I mean, if I could give an analogy from when I was a, you know, practicing oncologist for the last decade on, you know, until the day before I came here. I hope to get my clinic back going again soon someday. You know, you would have a patient come in, and we're talking about disease that's everywhere. Lung cancer, widespread metastatic disease in the belly, in the lungs, even in the brain. I've even seen a comatose patient come in with brain metastases. We powdered up one of these drugs and put it down a Dabhoff tube, and that woman woke up. She had a Lazarus-like effect from this. So we're talking about extremely potent targeted drugs. We're working on durability, you know, making them last. This one has a median duration response, I think, about a year. But we don't want just 1 year. We want these drugs to work for 3 years and 5 years and like Gleevec, 27 years. That's work in progress. But we never let the perfect be the enemy of the good. And this is a great product, extremely promising. I think everyone, patients, doctors, the company, us, we're all excited.
And to Sanjula's point, you know, I remember from being in the operating room involved in lung resections is... these drugs dramatically change the margin of resection, and that directly correlates with the amount of disability from the procedure. I mean, preserving healthy lung tissue, especially in an older individual, where there's a risk of lung tumor recurrence, that is a very valuable endpoint in a surgery. So, these response rates are impressive, and reducing the margin of resection, there's a real benefit there.
And that fits with the next one, dostarlimab.
Dostarlimab.
Surgery.
Oh, we should also mention the KRAS inhibitor for pancreatic and maybe other cancers, but pancreatic cancer.
We announced
by Revolution Medicine. Yeah, we announced that one, but we could talk about that one too. But dostarlimab,
yeah,
one of those incredible things, again, potentially promising. We now have some good clinical data. We have to look at the totality of data that is submitted. But individuals who have had tumors in the rectum, these are typically for GI cancers with a microsatellite instability resulting in some mismatch mutation. So they have, and that might be 5 or 7 or 10%, depending on the population of people with a GI tumor, but they have had a complete pathologic response. And I mean, there's nothing that gets an oncologist or Bigfoot more excited than a complete response, a complete pathologic response, not to be confused with CPR, and not to be confused with a CR letter that goes up.
You shouldn't confuse
the
two. But
a complete response, unbelievable, without the need for chemo, surgery, or radiation. So they're following people now that have had a CR, and they're following them. And it appears that there's some potentially promising results here.
I like that product because, people forget that, like, the rectum anatomically is so close to the end of the GI tract that treating those cancers has always been kind of tricky. We use chemotherapy in combination with radiotherapy because the rectum, unlike the colon, is fixed in place. It doesn't move around, so you can hit it with radiation. That's toxic. I mean, people don't like going through that. I mean, they can have rectal bleeding. They can have pain. They can have, constipation, proctitis. I mean, it can really hurt. After that, if they do well after that, they're rewarded with a surgical resection, which again often requires an ostomy placement where the gut is rerouted to the skin and only later connected. And people don't, and that's your reward for having done well on chemo RT. And that's been the standard of care for, 30, 40 years. Instead of that, for these people with the mismatch repair deficiency and MSI high tumors, as you say, like a 10, 15% of people, instead of that.
Was it that as much as 15%?
Yeah, I think it's slightly different in early stage, is a little bit higher than in later stage, but 10, 15%, I think, easily.
That's good.
And they get this IV medication. The toxicity profile is, like, compared to chemotherapy, this is like a breeze. I mean,
it's like a haircut.
Yeah, it's like a haircut.
That's huge for cancer patients, right? I mean, these treatments are brutal.
I think chemo RT is brutal. Yeah.
So, Gary, did I cut you off?
No, go ahead.
I was going to say, I've had cancer patients, when you start explaining the regimen, the chemo regimen, they start zoning out, like, no, thank you. Just, I'm going to just live my life. And you wonder if you could offer an alternative that doesn't have the toxicity, doesn't have the sessions where you come in and sit in the, park in the lot and get your parking validated and navigate a campus map and sit in a chemo chair and
not always validated.
Check in, they're not validated. And surgery has risks, no matter, you know, how good of a candidate you are. So,
and immunotherapy, I mean, it's not side effect free. There are occasionally autoimmune things that happen, but it's just worth pointing that. But dostarlimab is much better than chemo RT and surgery. There's no question about it in terms of tolerability. And these patients, not only the tumor shrink, but you can take you can do a colonoscopy. You don't see any tumor. You can biopsy the rectum at random. You don't see any tumor. I mean, we're talking about near total eradication in the people who've had this done, and then they're being followed. They're not requiring chemo RT. They're not requiring surgery. You know, everyone knows that I don't like the term game changer. I think it's used too loosely. But I think this is really at that level where you spare me all this. Before I even joined the FDA, we hypothesized that doing randomized studies here doesn't make sense. Because I'm a patient with this, I don't want to be randomized to the old way. And we actually devised, people can pull our paper, it's called the Parachute Study Design, a different study design, which is kind of innovative stuff we talk with Rick about.
Yeah, if you see a tumor melt away with a complete response, do you want to get randomized?
No, you don't.
You have to, this is where Rick is a genius, right? Because he has thought a lot about the guidance that we give companies to do these studies early on. And if a company does that guidance, look, it's a pretty simple pathway here.
Yeah.
If you follow the guidance and the drug works, it's going to get approved. And so it's a pretty simple path. But I'd say it's cool seeing that, you know, to be able to be here at a time when we may be able to usher in some of these potentially promising treatments. It is really cool. And the piece of it that I like as a sort of a side benefit is that in thinking about the healthcare system, the cost of all of these new medications and advancements in medicine, which we absolutely need, and we need to continue to advance and promote and incentivize innovation, it's making the healthcare system and state-of-the-art care out of reach for many people. And so this affordability issue is a real issue. And so we are actually seeing now medications that are reducing downstream healthcare utilization massively.
Well, dostarlimab might be one because although you pay for the price of the medication, you're not requiring chemo or
all the additional services. Yeah. Yep. I mean, you both probably remember this. A lot of the research I did prior to coming here was flagging some of these macro trends, particularly for the provider organizations, where we would model out and say these innovative future pipeline of therapies are going to fundamentally substitute or replace high margin, high volume procedures. And so this is kind of an example of that. And that does have cost savings long term.
And we've been hearing about medicines being cost effective, often, you know, a storyline to justify their widespread use for a long time. And the reality is the ROI just has not panned out.
Right.
I think we're at an inflection point now where we are actually seeing interventions that are going to reduce downstream healthcare costs, not by 2% or 5%, but by a, you know, 50, 80%. I mean, think about some of these interventions. I mean, avoiding the need of a low anterior rectal resection, avoiding the need for chemotherapy, avoiding the need for radiation sessions 3 times a week for 12 weeks. I mean, it is an exciting time. And we
let alone your biosimilars. So I mean, one way you're lowering cost is by introducing products to market that reduce hospitalizations and other healthcare spending. The other way you're lowering costs is by introducing more options into the marketplace with more biosimilars. And each biosimilar probably roughly cuts the price of a branded product by maybe 10 percentage points as you have
sometimes
more.
Sometimes can be even greater.
Once you get 2 or 3 biosimilars,
yes, then the market plummets.
Especially 3.
Yeah.
And you really see those prices come down, and that's what we want. Lower drug prices for everyday, lower healthcare costs. We want to see this kind of stuff translate into, hey, you know what, your health insurance next year, premium is going to go down by 1.5%. I mean, that's where, you know, what we'd like to get to in a healthcare system to make it more affordable. Yeah, cool.
Good.
Yeah,
that's good.
Yeah, and hopefully more stuff on the plausible mechanism coming out soon. Maybe in the next couple of weeks, we'll be talking more about that.
Yeah, we'll be talking more. I know the journal paper came out. We'll be talking more about it in the next couple of weeks with some more press on it and more coverage on it.
Yeah, right. It's been a busy week. I mean, we've done a lot on the drug side. You've done some speaking on the food side as well. So there's a big agenda.
Big MAHA event.
Yep.
And met with the distribution companies, a critical part of our healthcare system, part that many people don't appreciate, packaging and distribution of devices and medications.
You know, that group said they historically have not really engaged with the FDA commissioner, but they're so appreciative to be able to be having these dialogues and be thinking about new innovative approaches.
Well, it's a national security issue. So
right.
We got to be talking about all this, and we need to talk to everybody. And at the same time, while we're out there talking to everybody, we need to be here doing our job and getting our work done. And if we are good employees here, we get to do our little play session and come out here and talk. So that was fun. So thanks for doing this.
Yeah. And I forgot, I mean, it's been a short but a bit productive week. We had the big HRT announcement this week as well, which has just been so well received and is a huge boon for women.
Huge boon for women. And maybe we should get an information page out there with some of the articles people have been asking for, some of the references, you know, the circulation paper in 2023, 2 years ago.
Yep.
That was a powerful review of 19 randomized controlled trials and showed a profound 48% reduction in long-term cardiovascular events and a 30% reduction in all-cause mortality in women who started HRT within 10 years of the onset of menopause. And so these are some profound new ways of thinking about public health. You know, unfortunately, people don't think of women as dying of a heart attack. It's just this old bias that lives in the, you know, the CPR, you know, mannequin is a man. And, you know, they just, you know, we tend to always just think heart disease is man's disease. Not true. It's the number one cause of death in women. Here's a powerful intervention that can reduce it at a magnitude perhaps greater than statins.
And I didn't realize, but apparently the warning label was also on like vaginal and topical estrogen.
Yeah, local forms. Yeah,
that's ridiculous.
Yeah, exactly. And
classic overreach. You know,
you think about the medical field. How much time, energy, and money goes into teaching CPR, which is important. We have to do it, and we should be doing it. And, you know, getting an AED machine in every bathroom and every mall in America or wherever they live.
Yeah.
For again, we should be doing it.
No. But you're saying the magnitude of the reduction is much bigger here.
What is that risk reduction? 10%?
You mean for having an AED in a mall?
And teaching CPR in every high school in America. Again, we need to do it.
It's important, yeah.
But I'm just saying.
I think it's hard to quantify. It's probably quite small, actually, because, I mean, CPR notoriously, it's still necessary, but
we do it
but often.
Let's just do a quick survey. So how many times have you done CPR, and how many times has it saved someone's life
to hospital discharge? I would say, I mean, probably only I've done it probably 300 times, 400 times, 500 times, something like that. And I've saved a life to hospital discharge 5 times, probably. Yep. And the 5 times were probably pulmonary embolism, where I pushed to TPA, shockable rhythms in somebody who, you can correct the underlying defect. They had ischemia or something like that. We have a paper on it, my research group from a prior life, on reversals, medical reversals in cardiopulmonary resuscitation. I think it's a Mayo Clinic paper. And it just shows that the field has had so many people trying things, and a lot of those efforts were in vain. It's a difficult to bring somebody back from being dead. Shockable rhythm is one thing and reversible cause is another, but, you know, asystole PEA with electrolyte derangements, a hospitalized patient who's otherwise very sick, you know, low probability.
And that's a success rate in the hospital when you have all the equipment.
Out of hospital, cardiac arrest, unobserved, for instance, like these are abysmally low success rates.
Yeah. Yeah. I had a brief stint as an EMT and we did them, you know, a handful of times.
Oh, but not a prior lives.
Yeah, I do.
Not a prior
no, that's cool. I was an EMT also. That's cool.
EMT too? I didn't know that.
I will say my success rate was a little better than 5 in 300. And I don't know if that's because I'm pushing harder or at a different patient
population. Because you're a surgeon. Yeah, you're a surgeon probably. You are more likely to have people who have less comorbidity. I'm an intern. I'm an oncologist, internist. Mm. I took a lot of bone marrow transplant and leukemia service over the years. And those are tough populations.
But it's just amazing. You talk about the risk reduction of CPR, again, which we should be doing and continue to teach. And the way we emphasize that and not ever talk about an intervention that may reduce cardiovascular fatal events by 30 to 50% in a population.
With that logic, next you'll talk about diet and exercise, Marty. I don't know what's going on.
So just to close up on that, how do you all recommend, you know, the medical curriculum, medical education really start teaching, you know, the power of HRT? I know the black box warning is a big key step in that, but what else can folks do to educate the next
generation? And that's such a big question. Medical education is so broken. They're so busy trying to hammer in everyone the names of the intermediary steps of the Krebs cycle. And so they don't have time to talk about menopause.
You know, they're very upset about this reduction in how much student loans you can take out for medical school, that has recently come through. Maybe med school shouldn't charge so much. You know, the cost
of medical school is okay. I opened a can of worms.
Yeah, don't get us started. Right.
Okay. The number of story for another lost. Day.
Yeah.
Okay.
Okay, well, it was a great event on HRT. Thanks for bringing that up. Great to see you guys, and we'll try to do something again soon on Plausible Mechanism.
Sounds good.